Our next segment features Susan Zimmet, author of Roses and Radicals, the epic story of how American women won the right to vote.
We're talking with Susan Zimmet, who is the author of Roses and Radicals, the epic story of how American women won the right to vote. Now, many people know that in 2020, we'll be celebrating the 100th year of women getting the right to vote nationally. But apparently in New York State, Susan, women won that right to vote earlier?
Well, basically what ends up happening is after a amendment is made to the Constitution in New York, in the country, after the Congress votes for it, then it has to go and be ratified by 3/4 of the states in order for it to actually become a law in the and a change to the Constitution. And so after it did get passed, then they had to first go out and get the 3/4 of the state. So there's different time frames of when each state voted to give women the right to vote. And 2020 is when the 37th state finally voted, which was Tennessee, and got us the right to vote.
Now, is New York easier than other states in terms of getting a right to vote? And certainly some of the lead-in, I guess, advocates for women's suffragette were from New York.
Well, many of the suffragists and many of the leaders of the movement were from New York, and a lot of it started in New York. There's no doubt about that. But actually, most of the Western states actually gave women the right to vote much quicker than the Eastern states. And actually, New York wasn't that easy. It had been up for ratification 3 years prior, and it actually failed. However, when it did finally come back in 1917, when New York State finally did pass it the second time, that really was sort of the tip of the iceberg that pushed the rest of the states to fall in line. But no, actually, the Western states were much more proactive in terms of giving women the right to vote very early on. A lot of states gave women the right to vote before we nationally won the right to vote, before the before Congress even voted to give us the right. And what happened was a lot of states, when they were first settling out west, they didn't have a lot of women. And so a lot of these states felt, first of all, that the women who did go with them to settle these states, that, you know, they worked just as hard as the men did to get out there and help settle the states. And they felt that they couldn't deny them the right to vote. But also, they wanted to get more women to move out there because there were so many men and so few women. So they felt if they advertised women would have the right to vote in the state, that they might get more women to move out there. So Western states actually were the head of the curve, and the Eastern states were the last states to join, which is surprising in today's day and age when you sort of think about it.
Now, when the Western states were given women the right to vote at an earlier stage, did that also mean more equality for women in other aspects of the law, such as property ownership?
I suspect they had a lot more rights because they went out there and they were given rights, basically, so they would move there and be part of there. So, yes.
Now, I think most people alive today, you know, 100 years ago, women got the right to vote. It would be incredible to people to think that you were denying a woman the right to vote. But, in fact, this was a very, very long fight, was it not?
It was a 70-year fight, but what would really amaze people more was not so much the right to vote. What would amaze people is that less than 90 years ago, women basically couldn't even speak in public. Women were owned by their husbands for all intents and purposes. When a woman married a man, she became his property. He could beat her and she had no recourse. She couldn't go to the police. There was no recourse. He could do whatever he wanted. If he wanted to take their child away and give it to the woman down the street, he could do that. If a woman did work, the money belonged to her husband and he could drink it, you know, and basically spend the money whatever way he wanted. If a woman inherited money from her husband, from her father, it became her husband's money. Women had no rights. Women couldn't go, girls didn't go to school. You know, they were only taught basically some of the basics, but they were expected to, at 13, 14, 15 years old, get married, have kids, take care of their husband, take care of their children, and not go out and work and not basically, you know, be involved politically in any way whatsoever. I think that's what's even more shocking is the fact of how few rights women actually had. And what ended up happening was the women that really led the charge on the woman's right to vote were really, it all came out of abolitionists. They were trying to actually get slavery abolished and get, you know, black men and women equal status. And so what happened was when a lot of these suffrage women they weren't suffragists at the time, they were anti-abolitionists, and they would go and fight for, you know, freedom for, you know, slaves. They were not allowed to speak at a lot of these meetings. They were denied a lot of basic rights. And so at an anti-slavery conference in England, a worldwide anti-slavery convention, the women were not allowed to speak. Even the women who traveled across the ocean, who were delegates to go speak, who we have now were starting to speak in America, weren't even allowed to be a part of it. They got sent and they had to sit upstairs behind a curtain. And that's where Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott started to talk. They met each other and said, wait, we've got no rights. What are we doing? And that's when they started to fight for their own rights. And so the right to vote came out of these women coming together to hold a convention on equal rights for women. And they were looking to have equal pay if they worked, to have control over their body, to be able to speak in public. The right to vote was not a part of this whole entire movement, but Elizabeth Cady Stanton had realized that women would really, truly not have any real freedom unless they had political freedom, which meant the right to vote. So Elizabeth Cady Stanton wrote into this Declaration of Sentiments that they were holding a convention about the right to vote. Actually, a lot of the women who were for equal rights thought by giving women the right to vote would make them look ridiculous and people would laugh at them. And actually, at the convention, Frederick Douglass, who was the actually only black man to be there, stood up and said to the women, without this right, you really truly don't have rights. And he convinced the women to vote, to add the right to vote into the Declaration of Sentiments. Ultimately, that's what we know the Declaration of Sentiments to be all about, is the right to vote, and that's ultimately what we got. But we still, as women, do not have equal rights in the Constitution. The only right we have protected in the Constitution as women is the right to vote. There were three constitutional amendments that were done to give black men equal rights above and beyond the right to vote. So women don't even realize how easily their rights could be eroded if, God forbid, our government became even more aggressive than our existing government is today. Well, we should be scared. I mean, when we look at today's government and we look at what's being said, and you hear some of the things that are coming out of some of the senators and congresspeople, I mean, most recently, I think it might have been a state senator most recently said that women getting raped and incest was basically God's will. So when you have people who really believe that type of thing, if we get more and more of those people in office, women have no clue how fast their rights could be lost in America.
In the late 70s and 80s, I remember the fight over trying to pass the Equal Rights Amendment, which, of course, was ultimately defeated. Ironically, Illinois was one of the states that actually sort of sealed its fate. But I haven't heard much these days about the fight over the Equal Rights Amendment.
Actually, no, interestingly enough, and I'm doing a lot of work on that also, the Equal Rights Amendment's 100th anniversary will be 2023. Now, we haven't passed it yet, and hopefully we can pass it by 2023, but that's when Alice Paul actually introduced it, had gotten it introduced into Congress, and it was actually introduced by Susan B. Anthony's nephew, actually introduced the Equal Rights Amendment. And so 2023 will be the 100th anniversary of an amendment that hopefully will get passed if we can really sort of, you know, gear ourselves up and keep working on it. I think right now, this moment in time, with the Me Too movement, with everything that's been going on with, you know, Trump, with all the sexual abuse and all the kind of things, women coming out in droves. I mean, this year alone, 26,000 women applied to Emily's List, which is a political organization that helps pro-choice women run for office. 26,000 women have applied to them to get training for running for office. And so never before have you had more women engaged than you do now. And I think at this moment in time, if we start really working on the Equal Rights Amendment to try to get that passed, I think we have a pretty good chance because of the environment right now.
So we're talking to Susan. You mentioned it took a 70-year campaign to win the woman's right to vote. What were some of the, you know, interesting tactics that, in fact, women resorted to over those 7 years?
Well, I think a lot of things that people don't know is that actually the suffragette movement was the first time civil disobedience was ever employed. It had never been employed before. But this was the second phase of the movement, because the movement was really two phases. You had the Susan B. Anthony, and you had the Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton, you know, in the very beginning years, Lucretia Mott, you know, and all those women who were going You know, speaking at different places, trying to educate people, going door to door, doing petitions. But then what happened was in the second phase, Alice Paul and Lucy Burns, who were much younger, had been in England. They saw the radicalization of the suffragists in England and what they were doing and how they chose to, like, actually do some actual violence. You know, they were breaking windows and, you know, defacing government property and whatever, and they really took it to an extreme, and Lucy Burns and Alice Paul got arrested in England. When they came back to America and saw how long the suffragists were fighting to get, you know, the right to vote, and how they weren't really getting very far, and how very few states were approving it, they started going to very radical means, and that's when they started to do the civil disobedience. They did civil disobedience, they were peaceful protests, but the president of the country didn't like it and whatever, and then because we ended up entering into World War I and the women would not stop protesting, they started to arrest them. So the women got arrested, and some of these women were actually congressional wives. Some of these women had actually been at the White House to have dinner, and these women got arrested. They got thrown into god-awful, horrific prisons, some of them that had been closed down forever, that were rat-infested, that were cold, that were disgusting. They got, you know, physically and, you know, abused, and then they went on hunger strikes, and then the women ended up getting force-fed, which was a very, very, very dangerous thing, you know, and a lot of them could have died, and a lot of them, their health was really, really put at risk because of the hunger strikes and stuff. So it was really the abuse of the women just for asking for their right to vote. That really, to me, is really the most astounding thing about the movement, that our own government, our own president, basically turned the forces of government against their own women just because they were asking for a right and they were doing it peacefully.
So, Susan, can you remind us again of the full name of the book? And, you know, where do you get it? And also, we'll just finish up with, so we are coming up to one century for the national right of women to vote. Any particular observations or celebrations are going to take place that people should be aware of?
Okay, well, the book is Roses and Radicals, the epic story of how American women won the right to vote. It's published by Viking Publishing, Random House, which is very exciting to have a book published by that amazing publishing house. The book is available anywhere. I mean, you can go into any bookstore and hopefully they'll have it or they'll order it for you. You can get it, of course, through Amazon or any other kind of online thing. You can get it through Barnes & Noble's online. What's been very, very exciting about the book is the reviews that we've been getting have been outstanding. We have been getting the most spectacular reviews that I can't believe. And we just most recently, today, I was told about 11 books that are must-reads for people, you know, who are interested in the Women's March, and ours is one of the 11 books. So that's exciting. 2020 is the 100th anniversary. I am actually on the Women's Suffrage Centennial Commission in New York State, and, you know, we're constantly every year planning different events and stuff, and hopefully we'll have a major celebration in New York State and all over the country for the 100th anniversary to basically celebrate our right to vote, but more importantly, to basically let the world know that we're here, and we're never going to go back, and we're never going to shut up, and we're never going to sit down quietly and not speak out.
And that was Susan, and this is Mark Dunley with WOOC.
That was Susan Zimmett on the women's suffrage movement and what it means today.